We're discussing the Rambam in his Mora Nevuchim, Section 2, Essay 33. Last week we had discussed Essay 32, which talked about prophecy in general, and how the Rambam had presented us with three different views on what the prophetic experience really is. For the Rambam, the prophetic experience involves intellectual preparation, and so therefore no two people can have the exact same kind of prophecy, just like no two people have the same way of thinking. And since prophecy is very much related to a person's unique intellect, so it's understandable why prophecy is unique to the person. And it was that which led the Rambam to say that no two people could have possibly experienced the revelation at Sinai in exactly the same way. If you recall, that's what we had reviewed or had gone over last week in the Rambam. This week, what we're seeing is the Rambam focusing in very carefully at how he understands the experience at Sinai, and he's very careful to tell us, as the great rationalist that Maimonides is, that because of the impossibility of God having anything to do with the physical world directly, when the Torah says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu communicated to a public way to millions of Jews, it was not exactly the way that the Psukim describe it. So what did you draw from the way the Rambam understands what happened at Har Sinai? What does anyone want to, put forward what they understood in the Rambam? Yes?
So the Jews in general just heard a very loud sound, which they knew to be something special, but they could not distinguish the words. Only Moshe Rabbeinu himself could distinguish the words.
Very good.
And he passed it on exactly word for word to the Jews.
And what did that sound? What did they understand from that sound?
Oh, okay. I didn't finish it.
Oh, okay. All right. Good. Yes, Patricia.
They understood the first two commandments, which are the two principles: the existence of God and His unity. And the rest of it, they said, they understood it, but they didn't hear it. Exactly, word for word. They heard a sound, they figured that that was what was being said.
Yes.
Moses translated it for them.
Okay.
And then they heard it from Moshe Rabbeinu. This is enough for us to go back up and the rest of it.
All right, good. And that's excellent, because the Rambam actually is invoking a midrash which says that the Jewish people only heard the first two commandments. So the Rambam says, you have to understand that when the Midrash says that they heard the first two commandments, they didn't hear the words as they are recorded in the Torah. They heard a sound. They heard a sound that they understood to be coming from Hashem. And that sound conveyed to them the meaning that is contained within the first two commandments, which was later said verbally to them by Moshe Rabbeinu. Now, why are the first two commandments different from the other eight, according to the Rambam? Now, when you look at the Medrash and the way that Rashi quotes it, and just the face value of the Medrash, it was that the people just became terrified after hearing the first two commandments, and they say to Moshe, "Va'al yedaber imanu Elokim penamus." We don't want God to speak to us directly anymore, lest we die. And therefore, "Daber ata imanu v'nishma." You, Moshe, speak to us instead. There's nothing conveyed by the text of the Torah in the way that the Medrash explains it as to why there was anything inherently different from the first two commandments versus the latter eight, other than the fact that people said, whoa, we're blown away by the first two, and we want you, Moshe, to give us the last eight. But if you look carefully in the Rambam, he says, no, there's something inherently different between the first two commandments of Anochi Hashem Elokecha and Lo Yihye Lecha Elohim Achirim, that I'm the Lord your God, and you may not have any other God, like Patricia said, referring to God's unity. There's something unique about those two that makes them different from the other eight, which is why they only were able to understand the first two, but not the latter eight. What is that? How does the Rambam phrase that? Anyone want to draw that out? Yes.
He talks about that the first two are unique and that you can arrive at them through reasoning. So therefore you don't need to be a prophet to have an edge.
That's right. Excellent. So for the Rambam, there's a rational kind of revelation where you come to the conclusion that you are in the presence of Hashem. You don't need to be a Navi, like Sherry says. You don't have to actually hear words of communication. But you just understand that you're having a divine revelation, a divine experience of communing with God, and that the nature of this God, you arrive at through just an intellectual understanding of who HaKadosh Baruch Hu is, that He's the Almighty. And as the Almighty, there can be no other than Hashem. So you don't need words for that. You don't need prophetic words for that. You don't need a prophetic communication. The last eight are much more specific to the way that the Jewish people are meant to behave as a moral and ethical people. And therefore, without a prophetic verbal communication as to exactly the rules, you don't understand. Just because you're standing in front of Hashem, you don't necessarily infer that information rationally. You have to hear from a prophet who tells you that you may not take the name of the Lord in vain. You have to observe the Sabbath. You have to honor your parents. You're not allowed to murder. You're not allowed to steal, etc., etc. And so this, for the Rambam, is really what the deeper meaning of the Midrash is. That assuming that the Jewish people... can we have the phones turned off, please?
Yeah.
Assuming that the Jewish people were not all prophets, because not everyone was able to rise to that level of the prophetic experience... that's why the Midrash says that they only heard the first two. They didn't really hear words. They understood that they were having a revelation from Hashem. Yeah.
Could this not poke a huge hole in the foundation of what we're learning? Because the foundation is that the miracle of Har Sinai had all of these witnesses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess it could. Maybe it could. Yeah. So as we mentioned last time, for the Rambam, if you had your video camera and your MP3 recorder at Har Sinai, you would not hear God's voice. You would not be able to capture God's voice on your digital recorder. You might capture the kolos uvrakim. You could capture the shofar sound. You could capture the fire atop the mountain. The audio-visual miracles, but the voice of Hashem for the Rambam is so removed from any physicality whatsoever that to attribute a physical voice to Hashem is anathema for the Rambam. And therefore he says, based upon his understanding of God's lack of connectivity to anything physical in this universe, and based on his understanding of prophecy, he concludes that there was not a voice that was heard, that was audible ontologically atop Har Sinai that reverberated throughout the desert. So that's the Rambam. Yeah.
The other question I have with this is that he said that all the other eight could not be perceived through intellect. Except that when you mentioned Shabbat, they all seem to be either between Adma Chavero or Mishpatim. Many other nations have the laws not to murder. We Jews are more specific in what murder constitutes, but really
that's an excellent point. Your question is an excellent question because you're saying, well, are not all of the Ten Commandments rational in their nature? Yes, absolutely. I think what the Rambam means to really say is it's not that these are like chukim. It's not like they're like, you know, purify yourselves with a red heifer. No. What he means to say is that just by virtue of the fact that I'm standing before God, I would not necessarily infer that these are the eight things that God is currently instructing me. In other words, there could be a lot of things that emanate from God. But dafka, that these eight things are coming from Hashem right now, I need a Navi to tell me. You're right, they're perfectly rational and reasonable, and we would have come to those conclusions on our own, even if Hashem wouldn't have commanded them to us, but to know that Hashem was giving us these specific eight at Maimon Har Sinai, we needed a Navi to tell us. That's the way the Rambam understands. Now, of course, there are other ways of understanding it too, because, you know, Rav Sadia Gaon says that all 10 of the 10 commandments really encapsulate all 613 mitzvahs. So maybe there would be another way of looking at it. But the Rambam says clearly the first two are what you conclude by any time you have this kind of experience that you're standing in Hashem's presence, and it's not even a verbal communication, it's just an experience of Hashem. and you infer that this God is unified and that it's Hashem and the master of all and everything and the King of Kings, etc. But everything else, all the other eight commandments, we would not infer. So Miriam's point is very well taken. In other words, if the basis of our faith for Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is the mass experience, the mass revelation at Har Sinai, so then that weakens that a little bit for the Rambam. The Rambam does not place as much, is not as invested in Maimed Har Sinai as Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is. But of course, you know, that together with Maimed Har Sinai, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is heavily invested in all the miracles that happened before Maimed Har Sinai as well, the plagues, the splitting of the Red Sea, and all the things that led up to that. All of that building up and climaxing in the mass revelation at Har Sinai is, for Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, experiential proof for the Jewish people of the fact that God communicates with us. Now, you should also realize that I don't think that we should really completely detach the importance of Maimed Har Sinai for the Rambam. Because even if at the end of the day there was no audible voice of Hashem being communicated, all of the Jewish people together, even according to the Rambam, are experiencing divine revelation in some way. Now, for each and every one of us, it's unique. But we can all turn to each other after the revelation and say, wow, we just stood in the presence of Hashem. That was something that all of them did acknowledge, even if they heard different things. Moshe heard a very, very clear, audible voice of Hashem. And perhaps his subordinates, who were also up on the mountain, the 70 elders and Aaron and his sons, heard a less audible voice, but a voice nonetheless. And then the Jews who were around the mountain, they didn't hear a voice at all. But they all experienced something, which was revelation. If you ask the Jew to say, well, what was the revelation? What words did you hear? He said, I didn't hear anything, but I knew that I was standing in the presence of Hashem. That in itself is very powerful. That in itself is, like the Rebbe Yehuda Halevi will say later on, is not something that can be fabricated. It's not something that you can lie about. There's no other religion that stakes the claim that there was mass revelation where millions of people experienced God in a revelatory experience face to face. And the Rambam can't deny the fact that it was panim el panim, because that's the way the Torah described the revelation at Har Sinai. It was a face-to-face revelation, even for the Rambam. It's just that the nature of the revelation was very different. Now we're going to look at the Kuzari. We'll see Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, who actually objectifies it and very much concretizes that experience and makes it much more part of the physical world. Did you want to...
You kind of answered the question, okay. But why we assume that prophecy should come in the simplest way you hear voice, like I'm talking to you? They say that, my question to you, how usually prophet gets? Does he have an audible experience?
Well, prophecy is...
a small voice anyhow?
Prophecy is described in different ways. In different parts of Tanakh. There's even a story in Tanakh that when Shmuel, the prophet Samuel, was a little boy, he was apprenticing by his mentor Eli, if you know the story at the beginning of Sefer Shmuel. And as a little boy, growing up in Eli's house, one night in the middle of the night, he hears a voice. And he thinks that it's Eli, who's his mentor, is calling out to him. So he runs over to Eli's bedroom and he says, what would you like? What can I do for you? And Eli says, what are you talking about? I wasn't calling out your name. And it turns out that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was calling to Shmuel, and Shmuel mistook Hashem's voice for Eli's voice. He had such a visceral kind of calling out to him that he actually thought he was hearing the voice of Eli, of a human being, instead of Hashem's voice. And so the Mefarshim explain that when you're in the sort of beginning stages of being a prophet, you don't really understand what you're hearing. And sometimes you could confuse Hashem's voice for a human voice until you become a more developed Navi. And so what becomes clear, I'm just giving that as one example, what becomes clear is that there are different stages of Nevuah depending upon the development and maturity, the spiritual maturity of the Navi in question. What the Rambam is saying is that for the Jewish people, there was no, they had no level of spiritual sophistication. They were a group of slaves that were, for the most part, idolatrous and had just come out of Egypt. We can't expect them to have developed that level of intellect to have been able to hear a real voice of Hashem. But what they did experience was a revelation nonetheless. Now let's take a look at Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi. So where are we? So we are on page 100 at the very bottom of paragraph 4. And if you recall, for Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, he says that the revelation at Har Sinai not only was it important in the sense that it was a mass revelation, but it also disproves the theory of prophecy that is put forth by philosophers. Philosophers argue that the prophetic experience is purely an intellectual, epistemological experience that is unique to the individual, that only can be experienced by the individual through his intellect, and there's nothing external about it that exists outside the mind. That's the way they understand a prophetic experience, and there is no kind of external reality about that prophetic or revelatory experience. And he says that the events that took place at Har Sinai actually disprove that theory. He's not denying that certain kinds of prophecy could be purely on an epistemological or internal to the mind level. However, he's saying that there's a higher level of revelation which can exist outside the body, can exist in the physical world, where Hashem reveals himself and allows his voice to be heard to all on an external level. Now this is clearly different from the Rambam, and that's something that we observed very, very early on when we talked about this last week. But he says that this belief of the philosophers was disproved by the great event at Sinai, which was an actual physical confrontation. It was further debunked by Hashem's own writing. Let me have someone read for us, please. Someone want to read paragraph 4, please? Anyone? Go ahead, Sherry, just loud.
It was further debunked by Hashem's own writing in that Hashem engraved those 10 commandments on 2 precious stone tablets. He then gave the tablets to Moshe, and the people were able to see Hashem's own writing just as they had heard Hashem's own voice. Moshe then made an ark for the tablets by divine decree and surrounded it with the famous tabernacle. The ark remained with the Jewish people as long as prophecy was prevalent among them, for about 900 years. When they sinned, the ark was hidden away, and Nebuchadnezzar conquered the nation and exiled them.
So you see that for Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, the physical artifacts of Hashem's interaction with the physical world are really quite significant. They're very important for the history of the Jewish people, for us to be able to confirm that we have had interfaces with Hashem at different stages of our history. According to Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, the reason why Hashem gave us a set of luchos to begin with, why did Hashem have to give us a set of tablets? Why were the tablets even necessary? Would we not have remembered the Ten Commandments without Hashem having Moshe bring down the luchos? Couldn't we have been a complete people without having a set of stone tablets that had the engraving of Hashem written on them? Why did Hashem bother to do that? Why is that so important? So for Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, the reason why it's important is because, and this is why the Aron is known as the Aron HaEdus in the Torah. The Aron Kodesh, we call it an Aron Kodesh, a holy ark. But if you look carefully in the Torah, especially look at Parshas Truma, where we talk about the construction of the ark, it's known as Aron HaEdut. It is the ark of what? Of witnessing, of testimony, of proof. This is the physical, tangible reminder to all of the Jewish people that we had a face-to-face encounter with Hashem, who brought himself into our world, into our physical world, and became a part of our physical reality. Which, of course, is very strange, because we know that the definition of Hashem's essence is to be completely transcendent, to completely go up and be beyond anything physical. It's absolutely anathema for us to imagine Hashem occupying any physical space. You know, that's especially true for the Rambam, who says that if a person believes in any kind of hagshama, any kind of physicality to Hashem, that's tantamount to idolatry. That's one of the reasons why, you know, what do we say in Yigdal? Ein lo demus haguf, v'yein no guf. What does that mean? God has no physical visage and no body whatsoever. That's an important principle of our faith. And yet for Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, yes, it's true, he agrees, God has no physical form, but he's still capable of having a physical voice, and he's still capable of inscribing on tablets, even though he has no hands, and he can say words, even though he has no voice box and no mouth. So there's a very, very delicate tread here. The Rambam prefers to err on the side of God's perfection and God's transcendence, and therefore God cannot be in any way connected with our physical world, and therefore emphasizes the removal of Hashem from the physical world. For Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, it's more important, although he acknowledges God's transcendence, it's more important for him to emphasize the connection, the very real, visceral connection that Hashem has between the Jewish people and himself through this revelation experience. So you see, we're dealing with very, very important philosophical topics, and we're beginning to understand why the worldviews of Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi and the Rambam begin to depart from each other, depending upon what is more important for them to emphasize. Now, we can study, perhaps, on a more analytical level, as to what prompted the Rambam to emphasize his transcendent God, and what caused Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi to emphasize his visceral God. But that's really, we really now get into the speculative, we get into speculation over here. So I'd rather not go there, but there's a lot that's been written about that as well. But do you see the tremendous chasm that is forming between Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi's worldview and the Rambam's worldview about Hashem, about revelation, about prophecy? And so this is just one example of the tremendous diversity of thought that begins to form in the medieval period. It's what, for me, this is why studying medieval philosophy and Jewish medieval thought is so fascinating, is that usually we find that there's tremendous diversity of emphasis, and really trying even to define some of the most fundamental issues of our faith, which is what was the revelation of Har Sinai, we see that there's not one clear-cut answer. You see that there's really two divergent schools, and we have to try and understand, like, well, what are the underpinnings of this? What is this based upon? Yes?
Could this be that Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi was writing more against the philosophers and Islam, and the Rambam was more worried about Christianity?
No, that's a good guess, but that would not be, you're on the right track, but that couldn't be it, because the Rambam lived in the same Islamic world as HaLevi. He lives about 50 years after Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, but they're both part of the Islamic philosophical world. But you're on the right track. In other words, there are two ways, you know, there are two ways to maintain your ground in a world where the culture is quite different from your worldview. One is to say the rest of the world can jump in a lake, and I'm going to tell you the way it really is. And the other way is to say that there's really not that much different from the way we view things and the way the rest of the world views things. You just have to understand Judaism properly. The Rambam was interested in reconciliation with philosophy, and Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi was interested in distinguishing Judaism from philosophy. And that's it, really, in a nutshell. It's much more complicated when we get into the nitty-gritty, but it really boils down to that. And, you know, that kind of dialectic in Jewish thought has continued to the present day, has continued to the 21st century. Are we interested in reconciliation or differentiation? Yes?
Okay, so we're living in these times, and in times where there was more limitations on communication, which so many barriers and boundaries have been either freed up or now we've been now bound up in a different way because of it. So we live in a world that's very different. So in those times, you could follow one or the other and not have your faith challenged by the other diverse philosophy. So we live now. And I think this is an approach that you're, like, it's consistent with when I hear you speak. So my question is, if you're hearing about all these different divergent philosophies, then where do you find the unification to build your faith, the common ground? Or where is that common seed? Is it, in this particular case, there was a revelation, we experienced it as a nation? Okay, then you go to, you know, Asia Tar will talk about it like this, but she'll be, once she'll talk about it less. And all those other things are, okay, that's all interesting, and I'll just kind of have it in my head somewhere, but that one little seed needs to be enough. And that's, I find it very challenging, to be honest, to have all this information and all this diversity.
TMI. Too much information. Yeah.
So we have
yes.
to have a basis for our faith. There has to be.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
How can my basis be this, so strongly this opinion, and someone else's very strongly another one, and we're all part of one nation, and, you know, you want to be building your emunah and not be questioning all
right,
of
it. Right, right. I don't, you know, the question is a very important question. I don't know that I can give you an answer that will necessarily satisfy everyone. But I'll tell you what I do. I have a split personality. And I... When I'm davening, when I'm trying to have a religious experience, I put all of this aside and I try to have emunah pshuta. And I say, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I know you're there. I know you're listening. I'm trying to connect with you. Whether you are the Maimonidean God or the Halevian God, that doesn't affect what's happening right now between you and me. I know that you're there. We have a Mesorah. And it doesn't really, the details of the revelation to me, on a practical level, in my daily life with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, are not important. As far as whether it happened, the revelation happened like the Rambam, or whether it happened according to Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. The experience of Hashem with Hashem right now has to be with Emunah Pshuta. It has to be putting aside all of the philosophical definitions and distinctions between the different Rishonim as to exactly what happens, exactly what prophecy is. Because, and I don't think that it's really like a split personality, like I don't view it as a contradiction. I think they're very, very easily reconciled. There's an intellectual part of me that has the curiosity to know what exactly is our tradition on certain issues, and then when I study them more, I realize that there are certain things that there is no dispute about, and then there are other things where there's a great, vast difference of opinion, sometimes two, sometimes three, sometimes 10 different opinions on certain theological or philosophical issues. And to me, that's a very expansive kind of educational experience when I am allowed to see that there's a broad band of acceptable ways of viewing things within Yiddishkeit. That to me is very enabling. It's expansive. It allows me to broaden my horizons when I think about these things within Jewish thought.
But like Maimonides has his 13 principles of faith.
Yes.
Like Maimonides is not the only, like, we have to have basic principles. So I could think off the top of my head of a couple of them. There are 39 malachas. I don't know too many opinions that are Catholic. They're right. You know, there was a revelation. You know, the land of Israel is our land that was given to us by God. I don't know what the other ones are. It would be really interesting to me, like, them, like, you know, listed what they are.
Yeah.
It just seems like there's so much, like, even my modern person puts a little faith. Oh, well, maybe those aren't actually accurate because there are other really strong opinions, and there are some, I think, actually that are debated.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, listen, what I always come back to is the last pasuk of Koheles. Shlomo HaMelech struggled with all these different opinions as well, but what did he say at the end of the day? Sof davar hakol nishma. At the end of the day, after everything has been heard, after we've tried to digest all the divergent different opinions about whether it's better to go to a house of mourning or whether to go to have a, to a house of festivity, and he contradicts himself a few times back and forth, he says, at the end of the day, you know what? Fear God and observe his mitzvahs, because that's the totality of man. And so there is a very important distinction that we all have to draw in our minds between the way that we live our lives according to halakha and according to Torah practice versus the different things that we study and the way that we understand and approach on an intellectual level the different ideas that are circulating within Judaism. For Shlomo HaMelech, the most important thing was to fear God and to do his mitzvos. And that's what unifies us, really. That's what really unifies us. The fact that I can go to an Eish or to this shul or to that shul, and we may have different opinions on a theological level, but at the end of the day, we're all shaking the same lulav. We're all putting on the same pair of tefillin, more or less. We're all observing the same Shabbos. We're all eating the same cholent, more or less. You know, so that's really what unifies us. That's really, and that's what counts. If there's anything that we're going to draw from the Kuzari, it's this. Practical Judaism is what Hashem is what Hashem emphasizes throughout the Torah. And it's important for you also to know that even the Rambam himself says in one place in his Mishnah commentary that when it comes to ideology, we don't say the halacha is this or that. You don't say that the halacha is like so-and-so when it comes to pure ideology that doesn't have any practical application in the way that we live our lives. So there could be two divergent opinions, and so someone says, well, who do we paskin like, or the Yehuda HaLevi or the Rambam? That's a silly question. We don't paskin when it comes to areas of theology. We study, we try to understand, we try to find those pathways within Jewish thought that stimulate us and that bring us to a higher spiritual plane. And we have the liberty to embrace certain ideas and to say that other ideas, while they may be perfectly valid for someone else, don't resonate with me. The thing that we do have to have unity on is the way that we practice Judaism. And that's really where it's at. I don't know if I'm giving you a satisfactory answer, but that's what works for me. And that's where I think is where it's all at. Yeah?
Question. The Rambam, the Mor Nebuchim, is a very controversial book, and a lot of people have a lot of problems with it. And it seems to me, to a certain extent, the Rambam was so taken with philosophy, and he's trying to reconcile philosophy with Judaism. Sometimes I get the sense they're not reconcilable, yet he's kind of taken in a little bit by philosophy.
Yes, he's been criticized for that. You're absolutely right.
Like we discussed earlier, yeah. If you take philosophy to its logical conclusion, God didn't create the world, Aristotle said God wasn't the creator, because why would he want to insert himself in the temporal world? And what? But yet, at the end of the day, we have a world that's been created, and believe it's created by God.
Yeah.
So there's an inherent contradiction.
Yeah.
Rambam seems to, on one hand, say God isn't as involved, but yet he has to be, because that's what we believe.
Correct. And so the Rambam even writes in his introduction to the Guide for the Perplexed, to the Mor Nebuchim, he says, you're going to find certain places where I'm contradicting myself in the Mor Nebuchim. I don't want you to think it's because I don't know what I'm talking about. He says, I know exactly what I'm talking about, but sometimes in order to be able to make this readable, there's things that are going to seem to be contradictory, and you need to study it carefully to reconcile the contradictions. The Rambam was a man who was very conflicted in life, in the way that he thought about things. And he did feel this need to reconcile with two truths that were very dear to him. One was the truth of Torah, and the other one was the truth of philosophy. And people experience conflicts in life all the time. What's beautiful about the Rambam is that he didn't just say, well, I got to choose one over the other. He says, no, I'm going to struggle until I am able to reconcile them.
But did he really, or did he end up...
Well, he claims to have been able to, whether you be the judge whether you feel that he did or not, but he claims to have been able to reconcile them. But one thing is clear. Despite the conflicts and struggles that the Rambam had to reconcile these two very different schools of thought, he also was the same person who compiled the Yad HaChazaka, which is the codification of all of Jewish law. And there he was not conflicted at all. You understand? And this goes back to what we're, you know, what we're saying to Terry, which is that it's the very same Rambam who experiences conflict in ideology and can come to some kind of peaceful resolution, at least in his own mind, to reconcile philosophy and Torah tradition, but at the other end is completely unflinching and uncompromising when it comes to the practice of Judaism, when it comes to halachic Judaism, when it comes to the way that he lives his life. There are some people who feel that the Rambam who wrote the Mor Nebuchim can't possibly be the Rambam who wrote the Yad HaChazakah. Like, they're two totally, this, like, really a split personality. But that would just be dishonest, because it really is. It's the same Rambam. And it's not a conflict, because the Rambam lived by living Judaism consistently, and you can struggle with Jewish thought. That's okay. We can live with conflict when it comes with the way that we think as Jews. We can't live with conflict and compromise when it comes to the way that we practice Judaism, the way that we observe the mitzvahs. And that's ultimately how we are to be judged as people, as the way that we behave. Yeah.
You know, if it's too off-topic, but she said something.
Nah, it's never too off-topic. Oy vey, look how late it is. We didn't get to the bunch. Okay, go ahead.
Is there another way to interpret this fear God? Because when you say that, you know, I tend to feel that it's more awesome. I mean, God is, I'm in awe of God. I love
God. Yes, that's what we mean by fear.
Fear, I think more Catholicism, like more.
Yes, yes. We mean to say to revere God is really a better translation. That's really what we mean.
Okay.